on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Today there are three of us on the air. We have our engineer, Jackie Norman, who will be doing an interview later, and my sidekick, Dennis Hart. Good morning, Dennis.
Paul, it is good to be with you again on this Wednesday. My goodness, we're becoming quite a tag team, aren't we?
Oh, we are. By the way, I'm Paul Wearson, and we are two old radio guys. We're sidekicks. Dennis Hart is now going to give us all the news fit to print.
And some probably not fit to print, some to air on radio. Hello, everybody. Let's start with this week's Boone News Republican, which reports that Thomas Brown has been elected mayor of the community of Madrid. He defeated Kurt Cruz in yesterday's vote, 577 for Brown, 184 for Cruz. Brown says this is important, Brown says, and we do too, because he says he supports Police Chief Rick Tasler. Why is that of interest? Because Cruz tried to fire Tasler last week when Cruz was mayor. The Madrid City Council refused Tasler's request. The council did not accept the termination letter that Cruz had sent to Tasler. Now, this issue has divided the Madrid community for months following several federal lawsuits that named Tasler, alleging that he or his officers have engaged in excessive force. So, as a result of all this, again, Thomas Brown, the new mayor of Madrid, and the community will be dealing with this and the outcome for a while. In the Nevada Journal, word that the Story County Justice Center in Nevada is going to take over some of Marshall County's civil caseload for at least a year in the aftermath of the tornado that severely damaged the courthouse in Marshalltown a couple of weeks ago. Four clerks from Marshall County have been transferred to Nevada to process cases starting this week. And one of the two judges scheduled to hear cases in Marshall County will move their dockets to Story County. Repairs to the Marshall County courthouse could take 12 to 18 months. Also in the journal, word that a Nevada man has been charged with stealing firearms and a truck from a Nevada home. 29-year-old Cole Michael Graves allegedly sent a text message to the victim admitting he did it. Graves could face up to 15 years in prison. Still on the crime beat, the journal reports that a Nevada man has been charged with stealing a pickup truck from a snow removal company in Nevada. 24-year-old Barry Arthur Downs could face up to 15 years in prison. And the journal reports that a Gospel at Sunset event is going to take place in Nevada on Friday, August 10th, at the City Hall parking lot, Lincoln Way and 6th in Nevada. The Central Presbyterian Praise Team and Band going to perform at this free event, and residents are invited to bring their own lawn chairs and enjoy the performance. In the Story City Herald, word that a Story City man has been charged with threatening to kill someone and refusing to comply with officers after he allegedly tried to flee the scene of an accident last Thursday. 31-year-old Jeffrey Allen Tedder Jr. was arrested after deputies went to the community of Maxwell following a report about a man who appeared to be intoxicated, who bought alcohol from a convenience store, then drove off in a vehicle with a child inside. Deputies later found the vehicle rolled over and discovered Tedder leaving a cornfield. He allegedly showed officers his middle finger, told them to come out and get him, and they did. He went to jail. Also in the Herald, a story about the Story City Library, which has had a busy summer indeed, with special programs that have attracted dozens of people at a time, and with its ongoing summer reading program. The story also features volunteers who help keep things humming right along. And there's a story about Brad Taylor of Roland Story High, who recently attended the Iowa Association of Agricultural Educators Conference in Ankeny. More than 200 secondary and post-secondary educators took part. In the Tri-County Times, word that the Huxley City Council has made it official. Council members named Jerry Stahl as Huxley's new police chief. Stahl is 51 years old, and he's a 26-year veteran of the police department. He grew up south of Boone, graduated from United Community Schools, and has had ties to the Huxley community throughout his life. He said one of the first things he wants to do is get his department ready for a new radio communication system, which may be in place next year. Huxley's police department has 5 full-time officers, including the chief, plus 2 part-time officers and 2 reserves. Stoll is replacing former Chief Mark Pote, who retired after almost 30 years in law enforcement. Also in the Tri-County Times, a feature story about a group of bicyclists who call themselves the Biking Conquistadors. They took part in RagRy, the Register's annual great bike ride across Iowa, last week, and they made an overnight stop, no, not in Ames, where thousands of other riders stayed on Tuesday, but in Huxley. The reason? The group's leader, Jim Legvold, is a Huxley native. So the 15 riders stayed at the home of Legvold's cousin. Group members came from all over the nation to take part in this event together, and they've been doing it for 13 years. And they all say they love the state of Iowa, but who doesn't? And that's your summary, Paul, of the week's news from the pages of the Boone News Republican, the Nevada Journal, the Story City Herald, and the Tri-County Times. Of course, the newspapers themselves will have even more news when their print editions come out this week, and I'll be back here on Friday with a look at news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I just keep coming back doing news.
Well, Dennis, you scoop all the print media. You know, this is going to appear later, so
it is.
You must be the newsman of the century to scoop all the local print media. How do you do that?
Well, you know, I like to consider myself Karnak, the character on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show who can
always
predict
knew what was in the envelope.
Predict the answers to questions that are in the envelope. I just rip the envelope open, and what pops out? News.
Well, you're going to be an immortal broadcaster for that feat.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm old enough to be something.
At our age, we hope we're immortal.
Yes.
Well, now we have a segment from Marshalltown, Dennis.
We do. As we reported just a few minutes ago, and as everybody knows, a couple of weeks ago, an EF3 tornado, a bad one, hit Marshalltown, damaging or destroying hundreds of buildings. Well, a few days ago, we had the pleasure of talking with Marshalltown Mayor Joel Greer, who was home when the tornado warnings first went out.
It was sunny, and there was no wind, there was no rain, but I've seen microcells before and knew something was coming, and it was the sound that they described as a train coming at you that made me run down to the basement. And at the office, my wife and staff did the same thing there. And then in the aftermath, I knew as a mayor, I knew I had to get to the fire station. And it took the strangest route to get there because I'd go up a street and, oh no, there's a huge tree that blocks the whole street. I'd try another street. Nope, there's a power line down where I would hit it and maybe snap it. It looked like a movie set. You know, they did Twister up near Eldora, and I've seen the movie set after they did that, and it kind of looked like that movie set here.
Describe, if you can, the extent of the damage that day. How many buildings? What did it look like?
The ones I saw just getting to the post office included Raycom, which is our communication center for the 911 calls around Iowa. They actually go into other states too. And they were missing the walls of the top four floors of a five-story building. And the trees that were blown over and uprooted were the most obvious ones. You could already see trees having gone through rooftops of houses on my route to the fire station. So it was pretty significant, and you could tell even in just the first look that we were going to have a lot of damage. And the real fear, of course, was if you'd seen the initial damage with all the bricks coming off buildings and falling on sidewalks downtown on 3rd Street, which is our usual route to get from home to office, there was a car that was absolutely crushed by a tree. So if anybody had been in it, they were going to be dead. That was the big fear. What was our body count going to be?
And miraculously, no one was killed.
Not only is no one killed, no one was seriously injured. It truly was a miracle. I'm not all that religious, but I got to tell you, we lucked out on that one.
The courthouse suffered some really severe damage. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was the toughest video to watch. You know, I'm a lawyer. I love that courthouse. I think it's the prettiest one in Iowa. And watching the Tupelo blow off was not easy. And by the way, a third of it blew off in the direction of the wind predominantly, which is to the east. And then it turned the corner left and went north for another half a block. It was the strangest thing I've seen in a weather event. And then when we had a tour the next day, the governor, lieutenant governor, Senator Ernst, Congressman Blum all came to Marshalltown, and so I was part of that entourage looking at the town. We literally went to the courthouse and we walked the five flights up to the fifth floor of the courthouse. It turns out we shouldn't have been doing that because they've now determined it's not structurally safe to be in there. But the damage there was more water than anything else. We had hardly any water in the event itself, but buildings like the courthouse had sprinkling systems, and so it was the water that had caused a lot of the damage internally, I mean, inside.
So county offices has had to be moved somewhere else.
Everybody's been moved somewhere else. City Hall, county offices. The county folks had the ability to move across the street to the Max building. Nice 5-story brick building that wasn't touched. It was actually built by Greg Miller, who was the Raycom person. His son, Mike, now runs Raycom. But they built that building. It's gorgeous. They rehabbed it. There was space in there, so they moved over there. And kitty corner to the southeast of the courthouse is where our county engineer's office is. They had some space available there. So most of the county people have just moved across the street.
Lennox Industries suffered a direct hit. How bad was the damage there, and what's the future now?
Well, Lennox is in the neighborhood that took the worst hit. They got the EF4. Lennox got basically its whole roof ripped off. How all of the people that were in Lennox, you know, they employed 900-plus people there in shifts, so I'm betting there were 300 or so people in the building. They all hunkered down into the restrooms, which were the safety areas, and nobody was hurt there. But the damage to that building was I think that is about the worst damage sustained. Now, that's talking about businesses. People lost their homes. I mean, there was a home. There is now a hole. I mean, totally lost their homes. And so that destruction is awful. But the Lennox plant obviously took the biggest hit for damage to businesses.
Lennox says it's going to rebuild. Any word on how long that might take and how much that might cost?
No and yes, in that order. I haven't heard yet what the engineers predict for how long it will take or what it will look like even. You know, they have to figure out how to rebuild it. And for how much it will cost, I know it will be over $100 million. I think I heard hundreds of millions, and that was from the mouth of their president and COO, who came up here from Dallas and met with me on Monday.
How important is it to your community that Lennox, with all those jobs, stays?
That's a good question. I was hopeful that even if they left, and I wouldn't have blamed them for leaving because the destruction was so bad, and you know they're going to be out of production for a long time. But I looked at Newton, and the way that Newton was able to withstand having Maytag leave, and now they're making the wind-powered devices, and they have the racetrack, and so they kind of came back to life despite suffering the big loss of a big manufacturer of appliances. So I was hopeful that we would still withstand it if they left, but I was really, really hoping they'd stay, and I was just so relieved to hear that. Here's what happened. The president came up, and he brought the middleman between him and our plant manager. So the three of them, plant manager, president, and the middleman, first met with the governor, lieutenant governor, and Debbie Durham, the state economic development person. That meeting was at 3:30. The meeting with me, and then I invited our city administrator and our economic development person and chamber person to join me, was at 4:30 p.m. And at 5:30 p.m. was our city council meeting. And I think they timed that meeting so that it would work. And what they asked us to do, they asked the governor, you do a press release. They asked me, you're the mayor, you let the city people know we're here to stay. So that was pretty exciting.
Tell me about the hospital. I understand that also had a direct hit, but miraculously, no one was injured. Tell me about that.
It had a direct hit. You know, we have two facilities now. We built the brand new state-of-the-art, best state-of-the-art in the state, surgical center, wound center out south of town near Highway 30. The older hospital was the one that sustained the hit, and nobody was injured, staff or patients. Patients had to be relocated for a while. Within a week, we were able to put patients back in the hospital. As you might know, Unity Point has become part of our hospital. It now runs our hospital. We love the people that are here in town doing that. And I can't believe that they were able to get patients back in that hospital facility within a week of the tornado.
Talk a little bit about the damage in the neighborhoods. I know that some of the neighborhoods in the north part of the city were just severely hit.
North and east. We're in the north. On our block, we had trees go through roofs into kitchens. So significant damage. Just at Fifth and Hughes is where we live. But it was the one day I had to get back to the fire department, and I had to deviate quite a bit, quite a ways away because of all the trucks that were here to do the cleanup, that I got my first self-guided tour of the east side of Marshalltown, including driving past the Lennox plant. And that damage was nothing less than just devastating. There are still people that are sleeping on their front lawns because they don't have, they have a hole where the house used to be, or they're sleeping in their cars and the cars don't have any windows because they were all blown out or knocked out by flying debris.
After all of this, how is the recovery effort going in Marshalltown?
The weird thing is it's going so well that it's almost counterproductive because we need financial relief and we need people to know we're still in a big world of hurt, and a lot of people we suspect are not well insured, especially on the east side of town. But the relief and the recovery and the outpouring of volunteers is something that the people who have been in these disaster areas, if you talk to some of the people that are, that have come in here from the Red Cross, for instance, from all over the country, this will be their fifth or tenth disaster where they've shown up and set up camp and helped people. And we happen to have a guy out from North Carolina. He was here in Iowa for a convention. He's been through, this was his job, basically. He's been through these things. He came up to help, and he and the other volunteers have said they've never seen a cleanup so fast. Immediately, people were here, a lot of them from Parkersburg, you know. They came with chainsaws, they came with pickup trucks, carts, and the debris removal from all of the trees that are down and from the homes was just incredible.
You briefly met with President Trump when he came to Dubuque last week. What were you able to tell him?
Not much. Welcome to Iowa. He asked, how are you doing? I reflexively said, fine, and then realized this may be my only audience with him. So I said, but we still need help. And that was the extent of the conversation. The receiving line when he came off the airplane was pretty fast. And there were not many of us in that line. It was the governor, lieutenant governor, Congressman Blum's wife, the Pella mayor, me, the Bondurant mayor, and they wanted somebody who was a first responder, so I took with me, well, I didn't take with me, he drove me as my Uber driver, our assistant fire chief, who is a first responder. And immediately after they went through the receiving line, they went over to a cordoned off area that was fenced and had a lot of Trump supporters, and there the conversations began.
What's your understanding about the prospect of getting some federal money to help out?
Senator Grassley came for a visit. While we were touring the town, he was stopped by a reporter and was asked that same question. And I heard him answer, well, in Cedar Rapids, we just now finally got clearance from the Corps of Engineers exactly a decade after the flood to spend the money that we have available to do some repair and work for the next flood that comes. So he's basically saying, if you get FEMA money, it may take a while.
I understand the Bobcats baseball team, Marshalltown's high school baseball team, had a big impact not just in terms of cleanup, but in the morale of the community while they were in the state playoffs. Talk a little bit about that.
Boy, that team has some really good athletes in other sports, too. Some are going on to play other sports, but our baseball team's been fun to watch every year. Coach Hansen, he can take a bunch of kids that aren't winning games at the beginning of the season, but by George, they figure out how to get into this state, which they did. And one fun thing was three of our really good community citizens decided, you know what, we need to bus people over to that game. So they secured a bus and gave people free rides to go to the baseball game. And just seeing that was available and knowing that we had a team that could make it all the way to the top of the state, which we did about 12 years ago, that was a pretty good morale booster, truly. And they played well. I guess there was one bad inning where there were five runs that kind of put us in the hole, but nice kids, and a lot of people went down to watch them.
It was a good morale booster for the community.
It was, yeah.
What would you like our listeners to know in summing up about how Marshalltown's coping with what happened?
I was interviewed 2 weeks before the tornado by WHO TV and asked, with the Ames mayor, in fact. I like him. He's a good man. And we were both asked to write one word down on a tablet that would describe our city. And he wrote down people because of so many good people resources names. I wrote down the word collaborate. We have so much collaboration here in this town. All of the city leaders, the school, the county, the employers, everybody knows each other, and we trust each other, and we work well together. And so this town, even if we had lost Lennox and JBS and some of the other major employers, we would survive. We'd be a Phoenix town that would come back and be fine. And actually, because of this damage and talking to people in Cedar Rapids and Parkersburg and others that have experienced things like this, I know we're going to look better and be better in 5 years than we were 2 weeks before the tornado hit.
Well, Dennis, can you share an update from what you did with that mayor?
Yeah, Paul, I went to Marshalltown a couple of days ago to look at the damage myself, and it is startling. It's much more extensive than we thought from looking at television or reading the newspapers. Downtown, a lot of those buildings are in serious shape, will have to come down. It's going to take at least a year, maybe more, to recover. There is good news, again. Nobody was killed in this thing, only a few people injured. And Lennox, just this past Monday, announced that it's going to donate $500,000 toward recovery efforts. And, of course, Lennox has already announced they're going to stay in Marshalltown, rebuild that plant, and that's great because they employ hundreds of people in that community. So Marshalltown, though it's been hit, is, I'm happy to say, on the road to recovery.
Well, Dennis, I enjoyed that interview, and I was impressed by the upbeat spirit of the mayor and the resiliency. Always there's something that people reach into their gut and get when there's a disaster like that, and everyone pitches in. So the worst brings out often the best.
Indeed, in Marshalltown. And Joel Greer, the mayor, has done, I think, an outstanding job in rallying the community, and you could tell it in his voice, the upbeat spirit. We can overcome this. We've done things like this in the past. We can beat this.
Well, I know they will. And now we're going to talk about a good friend of mine, Howard Hammond, who is 88 years old, Mr. Slater, he was known as, and actually he did a lot of work here at KHOI. He helped us fundraise, and he was a frequent guest whenever we did material on Slater. And he just passed away last week, and we thought it would be fitting to remember Howard and highlight some of the things that have been done and the progress made in Slater, Iowa. And we've brought in an expert today, Louise O'Donnell. Hi, Louise.
Hello.
Good to have you here. And she knew Howard well.
Not as well as many people.
But you knew him. And he was a real spark plug down at Slater.
Yes, he was.
Tell me some of the things that he highlighted or actually motivated people to get done.
I don't think we would have a pool. I know we wouldn't have a historical association, the library, the trail that runs through town. He was somebody who charged ahead. Sometimes it ruffled feathers because he pushed. He asked to do things that were hard sometimes. But he was expert at networking people together, different coalitions, and bringing them together and having them work. He was at the Historical Society, which I'm involved with, the liaison to the town, the community club, the Legion, American Legion. He was a vet, and to the Historical Alliance in Story County, and to the Story County supervisors. He was our contact. We're going to miss him.
Yeah, it sounds like Howard was right there, sort of Johnny on the mark, at all points where decisions were made and new organizations created.
Yes.
And he was, as often people are, who were movers and shakers. Sometimes they do offend people because they want... Howard wants it right now, doesn't he? He wanted it right
now. Mm-hmm. Right. but very creative proposals, and I have an anecdote of my own. I'd moved back to Slater from living all over the United States, and I'm walking with my mother, and I ran into Howard with my mother. And he said, would you like to run for city council? And because my mother was standing there and it made her glow with pride, I said, yes, okay. I did nothing. I had no idea what it took. He did the petitions. He did the campaigning. And all of a sudden, I'm on the city council. That was how he just went and did. He never said an unkind word about anyone. He had a joy of life. You never heard him talk about himself or complain. Incredible enthusiasm and energy, and his eulogy was in his own words. he had been working on an autobiography for 25 years, and so they took his own words and they read them as the eulogy, and they were 10 points on basically how to live your life and a life of service.
And Howard really did personify the life of service.
Absolutely.
And he was 88 years old, and I saw Howard frequently up in Roland Story. Howard was a widower, but he was dating this wonderful girl, and they were always at Roland Story football games because her grandson played,
mm-hmm.
and Howard was there. And if you knew Howard, he had this, he always smiled. It was instinctive
yes.
of Howard to smile, wasn't it?
It was a grin.
Yeah, it was a grin. And he always wore these thin suspenders,
mm-hmm.
and I think he rode around in his bike wearing that same costume.
That's why it's so hard to understand that he's not around, because it was sudden, and somebody commented, to be 88 and have people so shocked and so amazed, because we just thought he would always, always be there.
Yeah, he was so durable. And well, Howard, he was a great dancer. He went to Robin's Ballroom.
Yeah, Lake Robbins.
Lake Robbins. And he was always involved with the senior variety show. Last
mm-hmm.
year, he and Jan mm-hmm. did this marvelous dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had the feeling that if you asked Howard to do something, the automatic answer was yes.
You know. Mm, yeah.
And here's a man, 88 years old,
mm-hmm.
and his death was precipitated by mm-hmm. being on his roof in the hottest day of the year with
right.
high humidity,
right?
Because he hadn't been ill or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just always impressed by Howard and his enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, he really personifies what one person can do to have
to
an
make
impact.
A difference.
Yeah.
To make a difference.
How
yes.
one person can do that.
Right.
And I was talking to Barb Mellon, and I think she is...
she's the president of the historical.
Right, mm-hmm. and she said, Howard is just like your experience,
mm-hmm.
great at recruiting people.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that Howard never left an open-ended question. He didn't ask you if you wanted to volunteer. He assumed you'd volunteer.
That's what happened to me.
Right? Exactly. That was your life experience.
Yeah.
And so
it was hard for some people to deal with that, because complacency is more comfortable than setting a goal and working towards it. Yeah.
But I think Howard was the kind of guy that he was so optimistic, so full of energy, and he created excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was
he
like
bristled
that.
With it.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. My brother was like that. He was a very successful Methodist minister,
mm-hmm.
and he created excitement, so
mm-hmm.
everyone wanted to be involved, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so,
whether you wanted to be or not.
Right.
Okay.
It
right.
wasn't. Sometimes it wasn't of your own volition. It was
right.
just, I guess Howard was a force in nature, and
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
he was just a glowing, wonderful personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were doing fundraising here at
mm-hmm.
KJOI.
Mm-hmm.
We were out at the front window. Just like the Today Show, you know, where people are walking by. And Howard made that work. And, of course, he was just such a piece of energy and optimism that he had no trouble being a broadcaster that day.
He was a talker, and they said when they rescued him from this room, he was still talking.
Yes,
you know,
I heard
so,
that, too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Howard was on the stretcher still
yes.
talking. He's been lucky the EMT people didn't get recruited to be on the city council.
One of the things that we weren't really, some of us, many of us weren't aware of, is that he had a doctorate, that he'd gone to school and he'd gotten his doctorate. But that's something he just never touted. He never...
Yeah, he
talked
was just,
about himself.
Yeah, he was modest and unassuming.
Right.
And he did have a lot of education. And
mm-hmm.
I think he and his wife ran a trailer park for a time.
Well, it's a Hammond Trailer Court.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's still called Hammond Trailer Court, although they sold it, yes.
And then they also had a storage area, I think.
He actually opened a restaurant called The Creamery.
And he did?
Yes, he did, on Main Street for several years, right.
Look at this man. He's an educated man. I think he worked with the Area Education Association
yes,
or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he was a professional man, with highly educated, but a down home, let's make it happen in Slater. And they called
mm-hmm.
him Mr. Slater.
Yes. my friends who lived in other communities in Story County referred to him as Mr. Slater, because he was the person, the voice, that would attend their meetings. Yeah.
Yeah, I just was very impressed with Howard, and he will be missed because,
absolutely.
You know, you know, when you look at his, like you mentioned, the library, the Historical Society.
The trail.
Mm-hmm. And he was instrumental in raising funding, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then recruiting people to be on boards and, mm-hmm. and groups mm-hmm. that ran these charities. Mm-hmm. And I just think that someone like that is irreplaceable.
I think so, too.
And he did die suddenly. In fact, Howard, you know, at the State Fair, they have the Iowan of the Day.
Yes.
And Howard was going to be. Tell us about that.
August 13th, I believe. His family is going to receive the honor in his place. Yeah. But it was to recognize Iowans who've made a difference. Yeah.
And Howard fits that to a T.
Absolutely.
I just wish he could have been there. And he will be in spirit.
He would have made a speech. Oh,
you know, that probably would have occupied the rest of the program. And everyone else is waiting to get their award. And Howard says, let me tell you about slavery.
He was full of joy.
Yeah, he was. And it was mm-hmm. Just a force of nature. And we mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. really hope that we can be that energetic, that involved, that committed mm-hmm. When you are in that age group in your late 80s. Mm-hmm. And he was such a smooth dancer and always out and about. I just will always remember Howard, and I was deeply shocked to see he had passed away. And I'm sure that all of us would envy someone who leaves such a mark in their community mm-hmm. as Howard did mm-hmm. because, you know, when you look at the library, the Historical Society, that bike trail, these are all tangible things that exist because Howard
actually conceived the idea in some cases and then pushed and got it to go.
Yeah, you see, and someone like that is irreplaceable mm-hmm. because there are people who make things happen. There are people who organize and recruit people. And he also indicates and shows by his life that you can't do it alone. You have to be the catalyst, the recruiter, the mm-hmm. impact person, mm-hmm. but if people don't follow you, it doesn't matter. But Howard, and I think a lot of people, and this is my theory, that a lot of people volunteered because Howard expected them to. You know.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
He expected her to. And
he was very honorable. You didn't want to let him down.
No. Mm-hmm. This is part of his persona. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, we know about famous people. We know about all the folks in history who've had an impact. Mm-hmm. We know who's in the news every day. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Howard was every man. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who live in our small towns and communities who really are what makes this country work.
Yeah.
Because anyone can make a speech. Anyone can be a politician or be on the air or do things that are very visible. But there has to be somebody out there in the trenches that makes things happen, that creates excitement. And I think that what Howard really did was foster a community pride in Slater, didn't he?
I think so. Yeah. Absolutely, yes, right.
Because mm-hmm. not only did you not want to disappoint Howard, mm-hmm. you also and you also wanted to work for Slater.
You wanted to live up to him.
And wasn't his slogan, make a greater Slater or something?
I'm not sure.
I've heard that from other free people. It was greater Slater.
It's on T-shirts anyway. Yeah.
Well, you know, he was always also able, as that indicates, to articulate what he believed in, what he thought should happen, and what mm-hmm. other people joined in to make happen. Mm-hmm. And we're really appreciative you came in today, Louise, mm-hmm. because we wanted to have someone who's been involved in Slater and continues to be there. Mm-hmm. But you know, we know people in retrospect by the people whose lives they've touched. And you're one of the folks who can testify that Howard did indeed touch so many people. And, you know, Howard Hammond, I'll miss Howard from his periodic appearances here on KHOI, and I'll miss him as a friend. Mm-hmm. And he's achieved a certain immortality. He'll always be Mr. Slater. And we mm-hmm. couldn't have a segment on Howard without broadcasting a little bit of audio with Howard. We talked about the 4th of July celebration. And He was describing historical societies in the area, how they got started. And I believe Howard actually created an environment where these historical societies could relate to each other.
He made an alliance. So he was helpful in forming that alliance.
Yeah, so the historical societies of several communities. Mm-hmm. Here's Howard, the actual Howard Hammond.
It actually started some years back when Sholo, obviously, because they were founded, 20-plus years before Slater, have some history that goes roots deeper than Slater. But along about the late 1990s, we decided it was time to be sure we captured some of the history of our communities for the area. So about 19, we actually formed up the so-called Slater Area Historical Association. And the purpose of that area concept was that we did include Sholo, so we two communities could work together. So we got our charter in January of 1999, and we have published a quarterly newsletter. We were able to work locally, financing, and we do have a museum. Well, we were able to reach out across the United States and come up with enough money to buy a $120,000 building. We got that in place about 2002. But one more thing I might say, why we've had the great support of the county supervisors is that we are unlike Jasper County and Boone County and some other counties in that they have a county association and buildings. And so it's built into their county budgets. But our supervisors have seen fit a minimal amount of money, not even as much as it costs you to buy a pickup truck today. They provide a few dollars to all of us. Equally so that we can sustain ourselves financially.
What I get from you is the fact that there's great community spirit here in causing this historical society not only to be there in place but also growing. And it's just a tremendous community spirit. How many people are involved on the board, Howard? Is there a board?
Yeah, a six-member board, annual meeting and budgeting and et cetera, et cetera. And now 250 members across the nation. So the managers are doing a great job, and I'd be deficient, and if anybody, any of them that may be listening to this broadcast, would say, Howard, you forgot to mention that it ties back to the 4th of July. They will be right in dead center, Nelson Park, under tents, and we will have film there because there'll be for sale tote bags, magnets, a DVD we put together on Faces of the Civil War, and then another magnificent DVD that's coming into place. I believe it'll be part of it will be shown there. It goes back to the days we tore down our first school building and gymnasium and built new facilities, and that is all documented with. And the people involved in the community at the time.
It was a
volunteer basis to tear the old building down. It was not done by contractors.
Is that right? The community did
right,
that.
Right, 1954. Yeah, and I guess nobody was insurance conscious then. Nobody got hit in the head with a 2x4.
Yeah, we took great risks then because nobody thought you'd get sued for anything.
Correct.
Now, also, Howard, is there an association of historical societies where these different communities relate to each other?
Yeah, let's admit to the listeners that was a lead-in question, because you know later this month there's going to be discussion, I think, by the station here about the alliance. What's happened is a brief of it, because they'll want to turn in and it'll be broadcast and they'll pick it up. But it turns out that Slater is one of the with 14 communities in our county. Slater's one of the 12 organizations within the county. Huxley has their association, Collins has theirs, etc. And the first founded historical society or association in our county was Maxwell in the mid-1960s. So we've all grown, and we have great support from each of our communities as well as our county board of supervisors. So what's happening in Slater-Sholo is happening throughout our county. So we have the preservation of history and bygone days really done well in our county.
Oh, yes, and a lot of these folks from different communities know each other, and there's you speak of the alliance.
Oh, precisely, yep. We meet as a group, representatives, two or three of us from each, or more if they want, from each of the organizations. We meet at different settings, at different places, so we can learn from each other. And We got to the point where Story City and Ames even have paid employees on the staff, and so that we bring in the professionalism of advancing this history. And so this alliance meets once in spring, once in fall. Representatives, there'll be 30 of us together, and we'll enjoy each other and swap stories about, well, how did you get that on? How did you do your inventory? And, well, how are you getting your funding? And where is it coming from? And how many grants is there out there we can get a hold of? And it's collaborative.
That's really great, because no one needs to reinvent the wheel. If one community or one historical society has had success doing this, that can be replicated in another community also, and they don't have to do trial and error. They can learn from what you've accomplished, mm-hmm. and certainly I think just talking to you today that it's very unique how successful they've been in the historical society down there and the marvelous achievements that they've already accomplished.
This is KHRY Community Radio.
Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. We've been talking about Howard Hammond, who passed away recently. Mr. Slater, who made things happen in that community, and he'll always be remembered as Mr. Slater.
Certainly an unforgettable man. Great interview. Thanks, Paul. Well, if you've driven on Interstate 35 here in Ames, and who hasn't, you probably have noticed all the construction going on involving a flyover bridge. But you may not know that construction has run into a bit of a problem. Well, Jackie Norman is here with a guest who can talk about all that and more. Jackie?
All right. Thank you, Dennis. I invited Scott Stoddicker. He's the District 1 engineer, and he's responsible for such counties as Story County and Harding County, Boone County, and Polk, just to name a couple. He's responsible for a big portion, 1/8, did you say?
The state has six districts. Central Iowa, 12 counties of Central Iowa.
12 counties. That's pretty impressive. Thanks for coming in today.
You bet.
All right. I just wanted to start off because, the construction we're specifically talking about, as Dennis said, is the flyover ramp on I-30. And I just was curious, just for some background information, was why did this construction start?
Well, the purpose of the flyover bridge is so that we can eliminate the weave movement on Interstate 35. Right now, people from Des Moines to Ames have to take a loop to get off, and at the same time, there's another loop with traffic coming on. So currently, people are driving 65 miles per hour on two lanes, and the people trying to take the loop are slowing down to get off, and the people getting on with the loop are merging, diverging, and it's a older design that doesn't fit the traffic volumes that we have right now, with over 40,000 cars on Interstate 35 and over 25,000 cars on US 30. So with the flyover, we can remove the loop in the northwest quadrant, and that will eliminate that merge-diverge issue on those heavy movements.
That's fair, and that would definitely help out when there's 10 times as amount of cars when there's a football game in town, too. So
yeah, exactly. For those high event traffic days, it will be a nice benefit to have.
Yes, it will be. So we were kind of talking about this a little bit before we got on air. When are you kind of hoping to get it done by?
Well, the hope was that the project would be done this year. And right now, you know, we've got some issues with fixing some of the piers that, you know, there's a chance that the contractor can marshal enough resources to get out there and complete the bridge yet this year. But there's the potential with the repairs that it could move into a next year project.
Okay. And what were the delays that kind of happened? I know that's kind of a dreaded question right now, but just for some information.
Well, there's two things, really. Number one, the bridge elevations are off by 3 to 6 inches. So the piers are too low, 3 to 6 inches across the board with the six piers. But that could be a really easy fix if that were the only issue that we had, because we would just design a steel plate that's 3 or 6 inches thick and put it on top of the pier, and it would be able to build a bridge with very little delay. The second issue, and the more important one, is that when we set our beams on top of the piers, those big 10-foot beams, we got to bolt them down. So we essentially put anchors through the beams into the piers that we have in the middle, the concrete piers. And those piers have a whole bunch of sleeves to take the anchors. So those sleeves aren't positioned correctly. During the pouring process, somehow they got adjusted and moved so that they're tilted. A vast majority of the 100 sleeves are off plumb, so that when you put the anchor bolt in, it's not up and down straight. It's crooked.
That would create stress in the wrong way, wouldn't it?
Well, you can't put the beam on top of it if the anchor is crooked, right. So it wouldn't fit. So we need to chip down to get to the bottom of that sleeve and then re-pour it. So they have to go down about 30 inches to take all those sleeves off and reposition the sleeves straight up and down.
Okay. With these issues, how much would you say this would set you back in, or set the contractors back in their original estimates?
Well, it's significant in terms of months. We've been dealing with this for a couple months now, so this is going to set the project time frame back a significant number of months.
Okay, and so I just noticed myself that you guys have, because it kind of you delayed construction for a little bit there. At least it seemed like there wasn't too much activity going on, and just recently it seems like there's been a little bit more activity. What has that been like since they've started really working on the construction site again?
Well, the delay was once we found out there was the air across the board, it was quite a process to figure out what to do to fix it. So there's a lot of back and forth with the contractor. We have to get a plan that we agree to fix in it, and they have to submit the plan to us and go through all the engineers and the calculations. So that takes weeks to get through that process, but then the contractor has to get back out there and start doing the fix. And so they've been out there the last month and a half or whatever time frame doing that fix, which essentially is chipping down 30 inches and trying not to hit any of the steel. They got to make sure they don't fracture any of the steel across there, and it's a significant amount of steel in those piers. So it's just a matter of them getting working and getting it so they can report.
That's great. So is it good for is it nice for you to see them getting back to work then after such a long delay?
Yeah, it would be preferable for me if they had three times the number of people out there working. So nice isn't necessarily a word I would use. I would like to see a significant number more people on the ground working on the project, but that's something that the department can't control. We can't force a contractor to bring in more people. When we set up these contracts, we give them a certain number of working days, and they can leave for a month and go somewhere else and come back as long as they get the job done in those working days. And if they go over, then we have liquidated damages, which on this project is pretty significant at $5,500 a day.
That's fair. And then I was just curious, after all these delays and stuff and all these issues that have popped up, what does a good day look like for you with this construction so far?
Well, as it relates to this project specifically, we haven't had very many good days in the last 3 months because there's just not much going on and there's not a significant amount of force on the ground working on it. But a really good day would be seeing the piers get poured. We should be within a week of starting to see some piers being formed back up and poured. And a better day would be seeing some beams start to be put up on top of those piers and anchored down. And a super day would be seeing the deck starting to get poured before winter hits.
Yeah, that would be a great day.
So those would be good days. I haven't got them, but that's the hope.
they'll be happening soon. So, and then I guess my final question would be, one of my final questions would be, will you be, I know I'll be regularly using the interchange myself. Is it something that you're going to be using once it's finished as well?
Oh, absolutely. With my district, I go down and I have all of the state roads in Polk County, so that's probably the busier area that I work in. So I'm constantly in the Des Moines area and coming back to Ames. That's the loop that I take right now, so I'll take the flyover when it's completed.
Are you going to look at it differently when you're using it?
Yeah, I'll probably think about it differently, but...
Well, now, Scott, I think prior to this project, I've heard that interchange was one of the more dangerous in Iowa. I knew someone who was killed there who was merging to go north.
Right.
I've always heard that was a particularly dangerous place because of what you said. There's so much traffic and so many distractions and hard to estimate speeds, and I think this probably, you'll never know, but it probably will save lives, you know, in the long run.
Yeah, I truly believe that also with the design that's out there was a good design in 1960. It's a difficult design in 2018 with the traffic that's significantly higher than it was back in 1960.
Scott, has the contractor indicated how these mistakes could possibly have been made?
Not yet. That's something that we haven't fully understood. More likely the sleeves just got adjusted during the construction process, people going in and out of those piers, because you send people down into the piers when the concrete's being poured to vibrate the concrete to make sure it's solid down at the bottom. So I suspect going in and out that they're just got adjusted, but that's really up for the contractor to finally determine what happened.
Does it give you less confidence in the contractor knowing this has happened?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if you guys had an event and somebody didn't set up the radio station correctly and you went off air for 2 hours, would you tell me that I don't have confidence in your radio station anymore? I would just say, well, your worker that worked on it that one day didn't do a good job.
Yeah. And mistakes happen. But it sounds like we need more workers. Now, that was never a problem building the pyramids because there was slave labor. But sometimes you'd like to see more folks out there working on the project currently. Is that right?
Well, correct. In addition, we've talked to the contractor, Minnewaw Construction, about bringing in other people, but the other firms aren't necessarily able to help out right now either. I mean, I've personally talked to a couple bridge building firms in Iowa and said, hey, do you have any opportunities to help out, and they're busy.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of difficult because we forget that resources are allocated among many projects, even for one contractor. They might be involved with several things. So it's complicated to coordinate that.
Well, in addition, Minnewaw is working in other parts of the state for the Iowa DOT. They're working on other bridges. So we're hopeful that once those bridges are done, they can move resources over to our bridge because, you know, they're not able to do as much work right now with the repair work. So it doesn't do them any good to bring in four sets of crews if they can only work on one pier right now. Right.
Scott, explain the penalties. When do they start kicking in for the contractor, and how does that work?
Well, the penalties are we set up the contracts so that in this particular job, we told the contractor, everybody bidding the documents, that they had 240 days to complete it, which means it's usually a two-year project. Now, somebody could have come in and completed it in 1 year. It was able to be done in 1 year if you would have brought in a lot of forces and completed it. So this ended up being a two-year project with the contractor, and so after 240 days of good weather, because we can't charge if it's snowing, it's actual working days that they can work on the contract, they will be charged $5,500 a day after that for every good day that they could work, that we consider a working day. So if this project carries over into the spring and early summer of next year, that's going to be a significant number of working days because we're pretty close to that 240 right now.
You don't know exactly when that day hits, that 240th day hits.
I suspect it will be in a couple weeks. I mean, right now it's always a give and take working on these contracts that they're saying, hey, you charged us some days that shouldn't have been charged, and we have to go back and negotiate all that and review the actual number of days. But they are significantly close to that 240.
And I think all of us can see in this room, having been there, they're not going to make it in 2 weeks. That's not going to happen. That's not even close.
No, sir, they're not going to.
I was just curious, when did they start construction on it?
Oh, they would have started last year.
Last year?
Early, yeah.
All right.
This is really instructive because, you know, we take for granted the roads we drive on and we forget the complexities in building them. And, you know, in the summer of 62, I hate to be the old guy here, my job in the summer was on a soils crew for the Highway Commission, we called it in those days. We were on a barge doing bridge sounding, that is soil sampling from the bottom of the river, where the 235 bridge is down by the library in Des Moines. That's an existing bridge. And every time I drive across it, I think and picture how the scene was in 1962 when there were so many run-down homes and bad areas down around that part of the river. And I take pride when I drive across the 235 bridge that I was out there on a barge doing the bridge sounding. Mm. And that's what we have to remember when we start to drive on this flyover, that, man, Scott and a lot of people sweat to get this done.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I've been working at the department for 31 years plus, and we've completed a lot of successful projects. We have Polk County, so we did all of 235, all of 3580. Almost every interchange in Des Moines has been rebuilt. Significant stretches on Highway 20 and Highway 30 all across our district. And what people don't understand is we've had problems on all of those projects. These are really complex construction projects. This one's just really visible to the public as you drive by, and the repairs have been really visible.
And this one will work out eventually. It'll get fixed.
Yes, it will. It will be built, and we will be using it at some point.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, Scott, yes, that was very informative, and now we all know what kind of things we have to deal with to make these wonderful roads in Iowa. Well, you've been listening to Local Talk. We've been your hosts, Dennis Hart and Paul Wearson, and Jackie Norman today. And we've been speaking with several folks, Louise O'Donnell from the Slater area. And we've talked to Scott here from the DOT about his project, and the mayor of Marshalltown about all of the things that are happening to rebuild.
And we've also learned that you, Paul, once worked in soil.
I did, yes.
Right. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. right here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear a recording of this broadcast later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the broadcast. Also, remember, please, that KHOI is streaming live online right now at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. You come in and join us at the Local Talk team here on 410 Douglas in Ames.
Remember, you, the listener, you are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you so much for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is sponsored in part by Ames Electric Services, reminding customers to always call in if you have a power outage, even if your neighbor has already called. Register your address and phone number online at www.cityofames.org/outage. Report a power outage by calling 515-239-5240. That's 515-239-5240.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, a member-based organization that develops business from group tours, leisure travel, and convention and meeting markets. More information at thinkames.com. That's thinkames.com.